The Afterburn Podcast is a proud supporter of Guns Gear and Memorial Foundation, helping our veterans and their families when they need it most. To learn more, visit gunsgarin.com/rain. I want to tell you about a service I've been using for over a year now, Aurora. I signed up and they immediately identified over 60 data brokers out there selling my information. The best part is they go right to work removing your information from these data brokerages. I have a link down below where you get a 14-day free trial. It's risk-free and you can cancel anytime. So it's worth taking a shot and seeing what information is out there. But it's more than just that. They have an app which includes antivirus, VPN, password management, all built into one package. You can use the app or you can use the browser to stay safe out there in the digital space. Again, I have a link down below. You can check it out for 2 weeks free. And if you don't like it, you can cancel anytime.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
Boom. All right. Welcome to the podcast. This is, we got three people on here today, which is non-standard, but Flash returning to the podcast. I think you'll be hearing more of his voice. If you haven't caught his episodes prior to this, he's been on several of the bro chats as well as just a dedicated episode, but Flash started his career flying the mighty A-10, which is going to be applicable for today. Then what moved on the world's greatest fighter to the F-16 and now is flying the F-35. But I couldn't have think of a better person to join me on this podcast to talk about what we're going to talk about today, which is the A-10. I have Hal join us, who has a new book out called Warplane here, right? We'll throw that up there for everyone to see, and we'll get Harold to throw there, which great book, really engaging. And I think, again, it's going to be interesting to hear the conversation today because Flash, ironically, is kind of woven into this book with the people he knows and the times he was flying the A-10 and transitioned out of the A-10. So with that, I'll turn it over to Flash, man, and let you kick this thing off.
All right. Thanks, Rain. Yeah, Hal, hell of a book, man. I thoroughly enjoyed reading it. Took me back and just could not be more pumped to be here and talk to you today. So the first question I'm going to ask you is what got you interested in this topic? You're writing for the New York Times Magazine and things of that nature. What made you kind of transition into writing this book as your first book?
Yeah, well, thank you for having me. And it's always a thrill for me to get to talk to, you know, fighter pilots and attack pilots. As a kid, I wanted to be a fighter pilot, but I'm red-green colorblind. And so that just kind of didn't really work out. And it's been fun for me in writing this, or in the process of writing this book, and then kind of afterwards talking to folks, because I feel like a little kid again, getting to talk to, you know, a bunch of fighter pilots and hog drivers and all of that. So thank you for having me. How I got interested in the A-10, in part, just I was interested in airplanes, but in the kind of months leading up to when I first started working on this book, I was actually working on a story about roller coaster design. And I'd gotten really interested in the idea of design in general. And for that story, I was like, oh, I never realized that anybody that being a roller coaster designer was a job. And what do you like? Do you go to school for that? What do you do? And I'd come up with this idea of, oh, it'd be cool to go to Disney World and Universal Studios and like ride on roller coasters with the people who designed them. And I was able to do that with some of the rides, and that story came out. And then when that came out, I had an agent reach out to me, and he was like, oh, have you thought about writing a book? And I was like, well, no, but I've been really interested in the A-10 for a super long time. Maybe there's a book in here somewhere. I have a lot of family in Tucson, Arizona, so I was surrounded by A-10s. I would go to Pima all the time, air shows at DM, all that kind of thing. And because of that, in recent years, I heard some of the news stuff about like, oh, are they going to retire the A-10? What's going to happen? And at the time, I didn't know much about it, but I figured, hey, this sounds like an interesting story. There's this sort of really, it's like the Millennium Falcon, like this sort of, not a hunk of junk, but this really old, durable airplane, this durable flying thing that's been around forever. How has it stuck around for all this time? And I mentioned this to my agent. He was like, oh, this seems like an interesting idea. And up until that point, it never even occurred to me that one of the people, you know, largely responsible for the A-10 coming into existence would still be alive. And that was this gentleman named Pierre Spray, who sadly passed away while I was kind of finishing up the book. So it would have been a couple of years ago now. But I emailed him. He was running a recording studio called Maple Shade. And on a whim, I, you know, filled out that general form that's like, contact us. And I was like, I don't even know if this is going to reach him. But hey, I'm interested in talking to you about how the A-10 came to be. And he wrote back, you know, I'd be happy to talk with you. And then from there, we just spent the next, I guess it would have been like 18 months or so. We would do a bunch of interviews on the phone. This was at first during COVID, so we couldn't really meet in person. So I would just get a tape recorder and put it on. I had thrown out my back. And so I was like reporting. I was like laying on the ground, writing like on my shoulders. And then I'd have the recorder there and I would ask a question here or there. But Pierre, I mean, he could just, you know, recount all these extraordinary details. And that's how the initial reporting started. And then we were able to meet in person and spend a bunch of time together as well. But that's how I got into it. I'd always had an interest in airplanes, but hadn't really considered writing about them. But it combined with my interest in design. And to me, I think the A-10 is one of the most interesting examples of purpose-built, human-centered design, among a whole bunch of other stuff, too. Sorry, that was a long answer to your question.
No, that's perfect. Because that was kind of like while I was reading the book, I just go, how did you get so much access? Was kind of the thought that I originally had, where you have this guy who knows pretty much from like right of World War II on, basically the innovators of combat aviation, like John Boyd, all these individuals that he had direct personal contact with, who is then just running a recording studio in the 2000s.
That you
reach out and you just go, hey, this airplane that is beloved by millions of people that have nothing to do with the military and then is so ingrained in the existence of combat attack pilots, like who is the person that was really responsible for its existence? And you were able to find that guy. And I just thought that was like the single coolest thing in the book, and just being able to get the access to all of these different stories to kind of weave the tale along the way. And then also get to talk to the pilots like Pierre did, to kind of get in depth into some of these things. So I thought the access was fantastic. I thought the story was great. If you could, like, as far as maybe some of the stories that weren't in the book or some of the stories that were in the book, but what was probably the one conversation with Pierre that stuck out in your mind from kind of the lead up to the actual publishing of the book?
Oh, goodness. A story like related to the A-10, you mean that?
Sure.
That connected. Yeah. Well, this ended up making it into the book, but I think this was early on when I was like, wow, there's like really a story. I mean, this feels like the kind of story I'd want to read, where he was describing early on, Pierre Spray drafted this thing called a presidential draft memo, some order of those words, where he basically was calling for the military to develop something like the A-10. This was in the mid-60s. And then as part of that process, he kind of had to defend this these recommendations. They weren't super popular because he was arguing for stuff that was cheaper and slower, and it wasn't of the sexy design of the time. And anyway, there was an effort to I don't want to say necessarily discredit, but challenge what he was endorsing. And so one of the things they had him do is they wanted him to meet with some Russian aviators who had flown and then since defected and could sort of tell Pierre, hey, this is a really bad idea. And so he met with this guy he was in a safe house in Virginia, or just kind of right outside DC. And he had defected by stealing a MiG, I think it was a MiG 17, and flying it like 100 feet below radar and bailing out just as he got over to sort of the West. And, Pierre and him ended up having this incredible conversation about, you know, they were talking about airplanes and all this, but I thought that was so interesting because that connected into this moment of, here's this guy, Pierre, but his story and what he's advocating for, like, it becomes a story about the Cold War and how did the events that were happening inform what we were designing. And I just thought that was so like interesting. I was like, that feels like something out of like a, you know, a Steven Spielberg movie, where I'm like, oh, this guy has stolen a MiG and he's flying below radar. And then the US is freaking out because like, how did this guy get past us in a, you know, a really old fighter? So that was just an early thing. I was like, that is so cool.
Yeah. And yeah. And then like when you're telling the story, the whole thing is they've been interrogating this guy for months, asking him about Russia's nuclear posture. This guy who is willing to steal a MiG-17 and ask him about Russia's nuclear posture. And he's just telling him, he's like, guys, I don't know. I don't know about any of that.
Like, I don't have access to that.
I just don't necessarily want to be Russian anymore. And, right. and when Pierre sits down with him, then they ask him, what interrogation training did you go through? Because you got more information out of this guy in 20 minutes than we've gotten in months. And it was his it seemed to be just his ability to relate to fighter pilots, seemingly. From somebody who
Which
had no
so
fighter
unusual.
Pilot background. Yeah.
Yeah. So I didn't mean to cut you off there. I was just going to say, it's so unusual because Pierre never flew, but he was able to connect with these guys. I mean, he and John Boyd were best friends, and John Boyd's like the quintessential fighter pilot. It's like John Boyd and Robin Olds on Chuck Yeager, you know, on the Mount Rushmore. I guess we'd need a fourth, but whoever that would be.
It's Rain, actually.
Rain, yeah,
definitely not me. It is definitely not me. It could be Flash.
No, that's awesome. From your kind of interviews with Pierre and all these different things, like did you went into actual A-10 squadrons, talked to some of the pilots throughout some of this stuff? Like, how did you get that access? Like, what steps did you kind of go through to get that? And then what are some of the stories that came out of some of those interactions?
Yeah, so Pierre, and I would tell him this, he was sort of my golden goose, because once he was had agreed to talk to me, he would then vouch for me to talk to a lot of other folks. And he would constantly just say like, oh yeah, you should talk to so-and-so and you should talk to so-and-so. And he was connected to everyone. And I think because of what I did, but you know, folks trusted Pierre so much, and it, particularly within the A-10 community, he had endeared himself so much to folks that if he was vouching for you, then you had kind of passed that level of access, and people would speak to you. And the folks who were the most helpful were the Maryland Air National Guard squadron out by Baltimore. They ended up being kind of the core group of hog drivers that I spoke with. And they had been in other places as well too, but that was my sort of real connecting point. In particular, Brian Bating, whose call sign is Master, and then Catherine Conrad, whose call sign is Slam. Do you know Slam by any chance?
I do. I know of them, actually. Yeah. I don't think I've met either of those individuals, but I got some buddies in the Baltimore Guard.
Oh, cool. Yeah, the Baltimore folks were. I mean, I'm just like so indebted to them. They were so friendly and kind to me. The coolest story, though, I heard from hog drivers talking about their experience actually was at Davis-Monthan. I was visiting for an air show at some point. I think it was in the wintertime. And I asked someone just kind of on a whim, oh, what's your, you know, most memorable story? I guess sort of like what would be a there I was type story. And this was such a quintessential, I think, hog driver story, because it wasn't about firing the gun or even attacking anyone or anything. The most memorable story this driver had to tell me was that there was a group of soldiers who were pinned down. They were like in a Humvee, and they were surrounded on all sides, and they called in for some close air support. And when the hog drivers got on the radio with them, they were like, what do you need the most? And the guys on the ground were like, honestly, we just need some sleep. And the hog drivers were like, we can help with that. And for like 4 hours, they just circled above to keep everyone else at bay. And the guys were able to sleep on the ground. And that is, you can't see I'm wearing long sleeves here, but I'm kind of getting goosebumps telling that story, because it's just not what you would expect when you think about a fighter or attack pilot and what's your most memorable story. And it's about, hey, we're going to let the whine of our engines be kind of like a noise machine and help these guys just get a few hours of rest. I just think that's incredible. It's such a unique thing.
The story sounds a little familiar.
Killer,
right?
Sound machine.
Yeah.
Flash did my, he might've mentioned that, during our interview we did, I guess I was back in May.
Yeah. That's an incredibly common theme. It's like the comfort of something, kind of like in your book, you're talking about presence versus lethality when you're saying, it's just like, it doesn't necessarily matter that the A-10 might be one of the most lethal machines ever created. It's just the fact that it's present. And when the A-10 was present, people could relax in a very hyper vigilant kind of environment. When those folks are kind of like at the start of your book, when it's talking about, we were always geared up for an ambush. Like that, like that kind of environment is incredibly stressful because you're just waiting for bad things to happen. And then potentially in the event that an A-10 is overhead, is that stress level goes down just a little bit because you're just like, somebody is watching our back, and somebody who is capable and talks the way we do and thinks like us and is very, very, very well trained to be able to handle a lot of situations that ground troops can find themselves in. Kind of allows that comfort to set in to where they can just get some sleep in a very high stress kind of environment. I thought it was very, very well told from some of that and kind of going there, but cool. So my other kind of questions that I have for you, like when I was reading some of the books, is like, through all this conversation, what is your take? What is your take on how we buy airplanes in the military or in the Air Force?
Oh man. I mean, my perspective is limited from based on who I've, you know, spoken to and all that. So those are all of my qualifiers. It's interesting. I think I'm going to give you kind of a long answer here, but
that's okay.
I think that the A-10 is an incredible platform. From talking with folks, it's not as easy as just saying, well, let's just spend a bunch more money and build a lot more A-10s, because of the infrastructure required to like build airplanes and assign those contracts and all of that. I don't know if that's necessarily a great excuse for why there aren't. But that is a reason I came to really appreciate, is because at a glance I was like, oh, here's this great machine, this great tool. Why don't we just build more of them? And it's like, well, to get a whole production line up and running, I mean, it's really difficult. Now, having said that, it does seem like high tech, high speed things are can be seductive in what they promise versus what they actually deliver on. That's not to say, and to be clear, you know, Pierre, for example, was a real big fan of certain fast planes like the F-16. You know, he had worked with John Boyd on helping to get that developed and all that. I don't know if that's a super satisfying answer. I think that it's a complex mechanism for trying to understand how do you like start up production for things, and how do you assign a contract? I guess part of it is you have to assign contracts to make it worth the while of the people who are building the airplanes. And it seems like, from my sort of somewhat limited perspective, one of the downsides with procuring more A-10s is because it's so relatively cheap, it's not, folks don't necessarily want to jump to bid on making that airplane.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's a super, the reason I'm delicate about that is because it can be sort of a charged conversation when you're talking about this old relic versus new things. And I certainly don't want to sound like someone just being like, oh, well, we shouldn't do new tech and all of that. We should just build the old things.
Absolutely. And like, as somebody that, like, when I was reading the book, it actually either affirmed or challenged the way I think about things, as someone who, again, like flies the F-35, who at the end of your book, where, or kind of the towards the 2/3 of the middle, is talking about this bloated government contract that with tons of cost overruns. And then you kind of look at it and it's like, for what? It's like, like when you kind of do these things, and it is an imperative of the military to build things to prevent catastrophic things from happening into the future. So you build these machines to deter, but then you subsequently still have to have things in your arsenal that are going to actually be effective on the things that are absolutely going to happen. So when right. you're saying like, how do you spend money? How is it cost effective? Is how do you have the right mix of aircraft or right mix of capabilities, if you will, to where you have to have these things. You're just like, hey, we're going to preclude something that might happen into the future and we're going to spend right. billions of dollars on it. However, I need to go ahead and set aside a few million over here for the things that we know are going to happen, are going to have the most impact for the individuals on the ground. Those third world conflicts you were kind of talking about, mm-hmm. special operations and things of that nature. And how do you have that mix? And then also how do you politicize that? How do you get it
right?
How do you get it funded? And how do you get it through the actual machine that is the current acquisitions process and how you fund these things? It's just an interesting kind of exploration into what you were talking about in the book. And I just thought, it was very, very well done. Hopefully a lot of people are going to take a look at it. And then again, like as far as getting into like the transitioning from kind of magazine writing to book writing, what were some of the challenges mm-hmm. you went through kind of getting some of that content?
So two things. One, just because you mentioned this to the acquisitions thing that I thought was interesting is in this tension between developing stuff for a future conflict versus stuff that's already proven to kind of need and exist and all that. Pierre and the group that he was with, these were the folks, they were first known as the Fighter Mafia, and then they kind of evolved into something called the Military Reformers. And they were the ones who helped expose in sort of the late 70s, early 80s, that we were having what were called readiness problems, which is we had a lot of airplanes on paper, basically, but how many of them were actually ready to fly right away? And the number was far less, in large part because to maintain them and keep them flying, it just required so much work. Pierre was the advocate for stuff being, as simple as possible and as simple and as small as possible. And he had folks who would disagree with him on this. I think that sometimes he, in a really interesting way, was drawn to sort of the extremes of that. One of his favorite airplanes was a British airplane called the Gnat, which was, it's like a fifth of the size of an A-10. And he was like, we should have like thousands of those and then they can always be flying. And, you know, people would detract from that because it's like, well, I mean, is that even feasible? But his argument was, if you want immediate close air support, the thing that matters most is how close are you to the folks that you're supporting? And the best way to make that as quickly as possible is to just have something already in the air. But there was that give and take between developing stuff for the future and maybe creating readiness problems versus creating the stuff that's practical and simple and can fly. That's such an interesting tension in my mind.
Yeah.
But moving from magazine stuff to book writing, it was weird because I'd never even thought about writing a book until my agent reached out to me and I was like, you know, it's really hard to get anyone to respond, like an agent to respond to emails or anything. I was like, okay, this guy's reached out to me. I'm not going to overthink this. I'm going to say, yeah, I've got an idea. Even though I sort of didn't, I was like, I'm interested generally in this airplane. And then because I was able to get in touch with Pierre, I just am eternally grateful for him spending all of this time with me. But the other weird thing was, or the challenge was, like in grad school, I remember I had a professor. Her name's Patty O'Toole, and she's a wonderful biographer. She's written biographies about Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson and a number of other folks. She was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. And she told us once that the difference between writing like a long feature story or magazine story and writing a book is like going from a birdhouse to a house. And when you build a house is not just a bigger birdhouse. It has all this other infrastructure wiring and pieces in it. And I had heard that, but it never really made sense to me until I started writing a book. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is like an order of multiple magnitudes more complex than I could possibly think of. And for me, the analogy I've come up with for what it's like to actually write a book is one time I was on a cross-country flight from New York to Phoenix, and we were flying into like a 200-mile-an-hour headwind. So we were going maybe 380 miles an hour east to west. And you could just feel the plane like just struggling to crawl through the air. And I was like, that's what writing a book is like, is you're just barely making progress. But it's like, ultimately I really enjoyed it, but it's an arduous thing. But I sort of didn't know what I was doing until I kind of jumped in and started talking to folks. And very quickly I was like, oh, Pierre's this fascinating individual. And then he was connected to these other group of really fascinating guys. And I was like, that feels like a story there, is to tell the story of this airplane through them and their work. So I wanted to kind of have it focused on the people as opposed to just the machine.
Can I jump in real quick? I wanted to, before we get too far away from the acquisition piece, because this maybe just stir the conversation with this, since we have Flash here. Flash, you know, obviously A-10, right? That's where you started your career out in, now flying the F-35. And Hal kind of mentioned it, it's the media, there's a rift, whatever, there's like this underlying tone, at least it existed, you know, 10 years ago, maybe it doesn't exist today, but you know, the capabilities, we're talking future, we're talking close air support, you know, why don't we keep the A-10 around? You know, what are the dynamics to go into this A-10 F-35? And now that you've flown both and you're looking out into the future, like, talk to me about the dynamics that are involved in all that.
Yeah, it's like it kind of goes along the lines of, there are no solutions, there are only trade-offs. And like we've talked about this before, is that when somebody came out and a lot of people did, they came out and they said the F-35 will replace the F-16 and the A-10. And you're like, no, it won't. You will trade off effectiveness. You will trade off capability in certain missions to get this very exquisite platform fielded and tested and ultimately into a capability that actually provides effects. So when you kind of look at some of that is the riff isn't necessarily with the two, just like Hal talked about, like the riff isn't necessarily with the two airplanes. The riff isn't with the mentality that you can just have a solution. It's like, yep, I have a solution. And the thing that, and Hal even touches on it in the book, the thing that is so ingrained into an attack pilot's mentality is that I don't care how the job gets done. I don't care who gets the job done, just as long as the job gets done. And so when you have a process that is more interested in what platform gets the job done than how it gets done, that is going to cause the issues. And so when you look at kind of how things are being built and how things are going right now, that is the biggest issue. There is not a single A-10 pilot who dislikes an F-35 pilot solely because they fly the F-35. You will dislike the F-35 pilot who will beat their chest in the bar and say that because I fly the F-35, the A-10 doesn't matter. Or when
Does
you
that
go, and, oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Wow.
It's like, and there, and then the other thing about it is there has been situations where you want to bring ideas forth in front of very high ranking individuals that can make decisions. And truly, because you're an A-10 pilot or you fly the A-10 or you're advocating on behalf of the A-10, like that ain't going to work. And so you need to be advocating for the right thing, for the right capability, or just change up your message or change who is delivering the message to actually get it in front of the right people. And so like, that's kind of the issue at hand about the things between like keeping the old in with the new or getting rid of the old in with the new. But you still just need the overall breadth of like the mix of the right capabilities to accomplish the missions that are both happening right now and could happen into the future. And then understanding that those things are in parallel and overlaying on top of each other. So if one airplane the capability or the platform or whatever that is supposed to handle the future fight can't handle what's going on right now or can't do what's going on right now, then what is it really doing? Because that future may never occur.
What is the, I love that distinction of sort of the problem or solution based versus platform based. What is the, and I promise this isn't a leading question, like what is the problem that the F-35 is solving right now?
The F-35 right now is just solving the technological kind of parity that is growing across all militaries. So when you look at it, it's like when you were touching on the F-117 in your book is, hey, look at what this airplane can do. It can go here where other airplanes cannot go. We are attempting to solve that issue via stealth. And then also just workload of the pilot through like the sensor fusion and things of that nature, and being able to do more with, some would argue, less is when we talked about it, or you talked about it, sorry. But we've talked about it in the past, is like Desert Storm is, you have these massive strike packages. Like, to accomplish the mission, you had to have these massive strike packages, Rolling Thunder in Vietnam and all these different things, like 8th Bomber Group in World War II and things of that nature. You had to have these massive strike packages. Well, what if you could accomplish the same strategic objective with 8 F-35s? Does that make war less lethal? Does that make war more palatable to people? Does it make it more cost effective by jumping the price up at the beginning to keep the price either of casualties or just treasure down in the long run? Through your book, we don't know. And so when you look at like, what is the thing that the F-35 is trying to accomplish, is in theory, just a lot like Boyd was talking about, all of these things that he was discussing were based on a lot of theory and not really necessarily proven in combat fact or anything that had been seen before. But in theory, this is like, these capabilities are going to provide the effects in a battlefield that we've never seen before. Me and Rain talked about it on our episode, where it's like war with insert pacing threat here, war with that, with those countries, is going to look different than any war we've ever fought in the history of ever. And so when you look at it, is you just go, okay, let's put in these capabilities because we think it's going to look like this. We need to have this. And so when you plug in those capabilities to provide the effects that you need, you end up getting yourself sometimes into trouble, but in the long run, it might be correct to have the F-35 that we kind of have. It's kind of what are we trying to accomplish? It's we're trying to beat the adversary at what they're trying to remove from us. Which is being able to put a bunch of aircraft into a piece of sky by shooting them all down. So let's put fewer aircraft that they can't see, and maybe we'll survive.
Yeah, that's such an interesting like tension as well, because you can't ignore trying to project the future, because then you will fall behind in some way that you can't predict. But if you are so focused on developing stuff for what may come or what is projected to come that you lose sight of the present, that also creates its own gap in problems too. It's I'm sympathetic to sort of both sides in that regard, and how do you innovate in a, I don't want to call it an industry, but in a realm or a sector where you have to both project for the future and solve problems immediately right now. I mean, where folks are flying as we speak, you know?
Yep. As you might be able to hear it outside my window.
The sound of freedom.
Rain, I was curious if you noticed like either like animosity across different platforms, or if it's more congenial than it's projected as. I mean, is it more like a friendly rivalry? I mean, how is it between sort of F-16 drivers and Hawk drivers, or F-35 pilots, or fighter pilots and bomber pilots? Like, I don't know. What's that vibe like?
Well, Flash definitely has more experience than I do with this, because he's jumped through all these different communities. But I mean, my take on, I've always had the friendly rivalry, right? You're going to give Hawk guys crap because they just can't go anywhere fast, right? Strike Eagles have twice the people, half the SA. There's someone sucking all the oxygen, right? But it's always been a friendly rivalry, because everyone brings different capabilities to the fight, different strengths and weaknesses, and knowing how to play off those strengths and weaknesses is important. Flash and I were talking before we hit record, you know, when the F-35 was really starting to come online, that's, I think, where people saw more media that was dropping out into the press saying, you know, the F-35 can't beat the A-10, or the A-10 can't beat the F-35. And it kept getting a lot of bad press, and F-35 kept getting a lot of bad press. I think they did a dogfight. I don't know, Flash, remember this? And somehow that made it to like Air Force times. And the F-35 just got, it was getting clubbed. And so there's a lot of, I think, press that popped around like aviation circles. It wasn't the people inside. It wasn't the fighter pilots flying around who were having this. It was people on the outside, which I think was influenced by a lot of, I don't know, bloggers or whatever it might be out there. But I don't know, Flash, I mean, what's your take on it? I default to there's always a friendly rivalry because you're always trying to be better than the person next to you.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. Not necessarily real animosity.
I agree. Like the friendly rivalry is the key term there. It's yes, I give Strike Eagle pilots a bunch of crap. I don't not like Strike Eagle pilots. Like it's not any of that. By the way, that is an incredibly capable airplane. But
a lot
you
of
do,
bombs.
You do
a lot of bombs
bomber,
of gas
or a bomber. Yeah. you do touch on in the book that what was it like 1,000. You could buy 1,000 of those Nats for 125 Strike Eagles or something of that.
That sounds about right. Something like that back then. Yeah.
But as far as the, I think the whole thing with the F-35 was how you're writing in your book that Pierre and Boyd and Dilger and all these guys are coming up with the A-10 and coming up with the F-16 and putting their, like, writing direct letters to the president. And doing all of this in a relatively kind of unmonitored age. So when the F-35 was coming along, it was in the Twitter age. It was in the advent of social media and Twitter and now X and all these different things where every misstep along the development of an airplane was played out in the media. To Rain's point, it was like, I think it purely just got a little bit more bad pub because of the access to bad pub. And so like everyone could have access to some of these publicly released reports. Whereas publicly released reports in 1957, you had to like, where did you go to get those? And so like all of these things that we're kind of looking at, just didn't happen. So I don't know. It's very interesting to me. Something that I kind of was chuckling about while reading your book was I was like, would the A-10 ever have existed if it was starting to be developed in 1995 versus 1965? And it's like, no chance would the, like, if you would have said, it's just like, hey, by the way, it's going to have this very niche capability of attacking Russian armor coming through the fold of gap. That's what we're going to do.
Right.
And we're going to spend like, I don't know, $4 billion to make 762 of them. And it was like nobody would have gotten laughed out of Congress. And so I think it's just an interesting kind of dynamic about the development of the AX came along truly for the platform at the perfect time. It was the Cold War. And it was basically like, if as long as you could just point that it would beat Russia, like then we're nailing it. And then all you had to do is get over the fact that it wasn't a nuclear delivering capability, or like it didn't deliver nuclear capability. That was the only thing you had to get past. And then somebody said depleted uranium and it got all weird. And then, so that was kind of the big thing. So like, as far as the stuff that's going on now, I think that's the animosity with the F-35. But then as far as just between the pilots and things like that, nobody cares as long as the job gets done. And I hope it stays that way. I'm finding in the F-35 that some people kind of read their own press clippings and adopt the mentality of that the F-35 can do no wrong. And that we're the only thing that can get in and out of some of these countries, but that's just not necessarily true. And you need the numbers as Pierre kind of stated with the whole thing. And we're seeing now with like, hey, we're just going to build a bunch of unmanned drones that fly alongside the F-35 or anything of that nature, like CCAs and things of that nature that are going to help out because we need to plus up them numbers because of the need. So you're seeing it play out today.
That's so interesting to imagine. Like, you're right that it was like the perfect sort of confluence of events at the right time for this really odd, ugly duckling airplane to come into existence.
Yeah.
And it just would, and I hadn't even considered that, like what the media scrutiny would have been like. I mean, because within the Pentagon, it caused quite a stir, but you know, it, I think more or less stayed contained within there, when Pierre was, you know, recommending all this stuff, versus today. That's just so interesting. I'm in a healthy way. I'm jealous of that point. That's a great point.
Yeah. To that point of how fast things move, like especially in those aviation, like blog and website spheres, for instance, Shiv, the A-10 demo pilot, he has an F-16 and an F-22 silhouette on the nose of his jet for kills. And that was when we went out and fought high aspect BFM and Flash. All right. Yeah. I got a default to you, but like we do at the merge, Shiv goes up, which I was surprised in A-10. You're not expecting the A-10 to go up, but he went up and then called us do it once, right? His nose falls over and he's like 4 miles away and calls a snap. I'm like, I mean, I get it's a big bullet. I'm like, that's a little stretch, but neither here nor there. Nonetheless, he like by the time he lands, they have those things on the nose of his jet. And then within 24 hours, right? Like everyone on social media is talking about the A-10 that has an F-16 and an F-22 silhouette on it. Mm. It's the same thing. Press, it flies fast in this day and age.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm gonna call BS. I don't think it was a valid shot, but Shiv, I'm still standing by that.
You know what? You know what, Rain? I love you. I was like, but like, I'm gonna default that was a valid shot until Shiv can prove it otherwise via video evidence.
$5.
And the thing that you say is like, by the time you were even out of your airplane, they had told that story. They'd put the silhouette on the thing. There is nobody. Actually, in my opinion, again, like aside from pilots, there is nobody that loves their airplane more than A-10 maintainers.
Mm. Yeah.
And it's like, I've talked to guys that have come from the A-10 over to the F-35 and they just go, man, it's like, I could just, hey, the right hydraulic system is out. It's like, well, is the left one good? Okay. Pull it out, throw it on the right. We got like, just go back. It's like the right and the left. Hey, where's the right hydraulic system part? And there's like, It's the hydraulic system part goes on both sides. And
when they were developing the thing, it was part of the specs. Yeah. And that's how they tested not just for flight capability, but they're like, we're going to have maintenance tests and which one's easier to maintain and which can be maintained quicker. I mean, but that's so cool to hear.
Yeah. I don't know. That's awesome. A9, man, it might've been a thing. I don't know.
Yeah. It was much sleeker looking. That's for sure.
Yeah. It was interesting. And then, yeah, just the whole, what came first, the airplane or the gun conversation is just tale as old as time that I just love. Can't get enough of it. And all the weirdness with the gun and putting the cowling on it and does the airplane slow down when you shoot it? And, having the engines fire the igniters every time you pull the trigger to kind of combat compressor stalls and things of that nature. All that development that went into it, because it was like, no, we have to have this gun. We'll make the airplane work as long as we have the gun, because I think a lot of developers maybe would have gotten rid of it. Because I can't design this airplane. I need to design this airplane to fly. I don't need to design this airplane that goes around this gun. But that was the capability, because like Pierre says, it's like when you unstructure the entire system, which I thought was an incredible, like a portion of the book that's like this, that just blew my mind, is the Pentagon, the acquisition process and the Pentagon itself is such a structured system where you have to go along this linear path to get to what you're trying to get to, is it removes independent thought from the equation. But they're saying like unstructuring the entire system, you boil down to the capability that you're talking about with like the Stuka pilots and how to kill tanks. And you just go, it was the gun. The gun killed the tank. Mm-hmm. It's like, it wasn't the airplane. It wasn't the pilot. It was the gun. The gun was the actual thing. Okay. So now that we've taken that thing and we've now determined what the actual critical element of the capability we need is, let's go ahead and develop that, and then we'll figure the rest out later. And I thought that was, that part kind of blew my mind with the whole thing and really changed the way I thought about a lot of things that are going on today, which is great. But man,
I'd gotten interested in this like human centered design stuff in general. And that's kind of, you know, when you're deconstructing something and getting at, okay, what is its purpose and what is it used for? And I didn't know this at the time, but that kind of like approach to design, or one way to think about it, is something called participatory action research, which is like a fancy term for basically you talk to the people who are going to use the tool or be helped by the tool and or the device or whatever you're building, and then go from there. And that really informed everything that Pierre and a lot of the folks who were involved with this airplane, how they thought about it. I mean, one time in a congressional hearing, it was like some senator or representative asked Pierre, like, how do you, not even in an antagonistic way, but he's like, how do you know all this stuff? And Pierre was like, well, I read a lot of books about, from, you know, pilot memoirs or soldiers' diaries and memoirs. And I talked to a lot of pilots and soldiers, you know, like that was his source was the primary source. Who's experienced combat or, you know, been on the ground and needed to be saved and, you know, wanted that saving to happen more quickly or more effectively or whatever. And it's amazing kind of how even today that continues to be an approach that is more novel than you would expect. And I guess it ties back to your point, which is a really interesting one, of building stuff with the platform in mind first rather than what is the problem it's solving. And that can be very seductive. But I just thought that was so interesting too. And Pierre never told me like, oh, I'm an advocate of human-centered design, but he totally, everything that he did totally was that. He just didn't label it in that way.
Are you a passionate aviation enthusiast? Then you'll be thrilled to hear about our sponsor, Aircore Aviation. This exciting company has been revolutionizing the aviation industry since 2008, and they have some amazing career opportunities available. More about that in just a minute. Aircore Aviation is at the forefront of airworthiness of legacy aircraft dating all the way back to World War II. Their dedicated team is involved in various aspects of aerospace, including manufacturing, fabrication, restoration, and support, using state-of-the-art technology. Their exceptional expertise in core manufacturing capabilities like metal forming, CNC machining, and complete aircraft rebuilding has led to the restoration of some award-winning aircraft, such as a couple P-51s, such as P-51 Thunderbird, Twilight Tier, and Sierra Sioux 2. And if you've been following me for a while, you might remember I was fortunate enough to fly over the Super Bowl in 2018 in Minneapolis. The formation was led by Sierra Sioux 2 alongside two A-10s and myself in the F-16, so this is a very cool full-circle experience. These incredible achievements have captured the attention of aircraft owners, aviation enthusiasts, and the general public alike. If you've always dreamt of a career in aviation, then Aircore Aviation is the perfect place for you. They are rapidly expanding their team in 2024 and have job openings in departments such as engineering and CAD, quality assurance, fabrication, and restoration. This is your chance to turn a passion into profession. Aircore Aviation is offering some amazing benefits for full-time positions, including health insurance, PTO, HSA, retirement plans, life insurance, and the extra perk of enjoying Fridays off. If you're ready to be part of a team dedicated to fulfilling the dreams through the preservation of historical aircraft, visit aircoreaviation.com/careers today and take the first step towards an exciting career in aviation. Again, that's aircoreaviation.com/careers. Don't miss out on this incredible opportunity.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
Yep. Yeah, I was chuckling because after reading your book, I went back and I was like, something sparked in my brain. I remember this article that was written. It was kind of along the lines of all the GAO reports that came out about the F-117 and the A-10 and Desert Storm and all these different things. And I was like, I remember reading this article one time about the B-2 dropping bombs in Afghanistan, like night one or night two of the Afghanistan war, or like Operation Enduring Freedom. It was like, hey, we're gonna go to Afghanistan. And they flew a couple B-2s, longest combat mission of all time. And the report was like this glowing report about the B-2. It says, completely neutralized the formidable like Afghani air defense and air force. Mm. And so I was like, I just Googled Afghani Air Force. They owned 35 airplanes, most of them helicopters in 2001. And we used two B, like, so we had these B-2s go do that. And I love the B-2 guys. I trust me, I'm a big B-2 fan. We need that airplane for certain things. But I was just chuckling. I was like, man, we really wanted to find a reason to use this airplane. And it was kind of along those lines that was kind of the thing. And what comes out of these things is a justification of taking the actions that we take sometimes.
It's interesting too. Like, Pierre and the reformers were never like, they didn't like love any particular platform or airframe. You know, their motto was people first. And it's why Pierre was so touched and surprised in a way by how the culture around the A-10 had grown, particularly in the years when he kind of left the Pentagon in the late 80s, early 90s, and then before he sort of came back into the fold later in the 2000s, and how that community had blossomed. And I'm sure that all in ways that I can't speak to, but all these other different platforms have very particular, special, and unique communities. But the funny thing was that Pierre ultimately actually didn't really like the A-10 all that much. I mean, he thinks it's a good airplane, but almost from the moment that it was built, he was like, we need to replace this thing, you know? And so when folks sometimes would get into an argument with him about like, oh, well, is it better than X, Y, or Z? He's like, well, I don't even think this is that great. Like, we need to keep developing and all that. And I just thought that was such a funny, interesting retort to if they were trying to kind of get him in a gotcha moment.
Thought it was too fast.
Yeah, he did. Little did he know.
And he got that from the Stuka pilot. Hans Rudel said, there's a quote, it's something along the lines of, when hunting tanks, speed is the enemy. Because the faster you're going, you can't see the ground and all of that. And which is one of those sort of simple statements that actually is still really surprising.
You just have to be able to get to the fight, though. That's the gotcha. You know, at some point, you got to be able to get to the fight. But if you could fly at 70 knots and just turn about your wing, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the A-10 does a pretty good job. It does a good job going slow.
So do other airplanes. We just need all of them. We need them all.
Folks have told me, too, Flash, I don't know if this holds true for you, but compared to other airframes, it's like folks have told me it's really fun to fly.
Oh, it's a blast.
Because it's still very agile. I mean, this is showing now where I'm out of my depth, but it's very maneuverable and all this. It's slow, but it can do a lot. And, you know, it has the gun and everything.
Yeah. No, it's an absolute. It does, in fact.
Does have the gun.
It does have the gun, which is the coolest thing I've ever done in an airplane is fire the A-10 gun. So it's an absolute blast. It's, I mean, the Rain knows, like, some of the stuff the F-16 can do, and some of the stuff the A-10 can do, the things that the F-35 can do on a different kind of on a different scale, but it's great. It was kind of a nostalgic read, if you will, of your book. Cause again, like, full disclosure, I haven't flown the airplane in 11 years. But it's been a while, which, bugs me, unfortunately.
So was it still the A-10A when you flew it?
No, actually, there were still some A-10As on the ramp, but they had
pretty much
all. Yep, they pretty much had all transitioned over to the sea by the time I got in there. In fact, all the airplane pictures you have in your house, like the lithos and things like that. The only lithos that were at the BX and the A-10 at DM were A-10As. So the litho I have from the A-10 from my B course time is an A-10A.
No kidding.
A/OA10A, but yeah. So, but the C, like, when they had fully done the transition over to the C, and man, what a what an airplane. It's a great airplane. And then the other thing that I saw in your book was the Engria, the National Guard appropriations. The fact that Engria owns the A-10, real nice. We were the first, the 74th, when we went to Afghanistan, we went to Bagram. And in your book, it says it, you're right. Bagram is the place the A-10 pilots want to be. It's what it was made for. But taking the Scorpion, our squadron was the first one to field the Scorpion and take it to combat.
And no kidding.
It was an amazing upgrade, amazing capability. So it was fantastic. So all those different things, the evolution of the A-10 and just being able to put more stuff on it from what it was originally designed for, just around the gun, is one, just kind of a continuance I think it was Dilger in your book. I might be getting some of the characters mixed up, but who just trolls the halls of the Pentagon, finding ways to get things added to the A-10 or finding ways to get things funded and approved and beg, borrow, and steal of at the moment, A-10 is doing things that are incredible, that are enhancing of fifth gen capabilities, next gen capabilities, and being more of a support asset to those things, as well as the traditional sort missions of CAS and CSAR and things like that. That spirit, is still alive and well in the A-10 community of just getting things done on the airplane while it's still a thing.
That's so wild that you, were with the first folks to use the Scorpion. Did you, did you go to the Bing at Bagram? Was the Bing bar built when you were there?
Yes.
Did I just get you in trouble by mentioning it?
No, not at all. Okay. No, the Bing, most certainly a place. In fact, the Bing that I
did you sign the inside of it?
Yep, and the patches that are at Pima.
Yep, yeah.
They literally picked the Bing up and put it at the Pima Air Museum with all of our patches on the wall, when the A-10s left Bagram. So yeah.
So I'm going to Tucson again next week. There's the Tucson Festival of Books, and I gotta pop into Pima again because I'll have to find your patch in there.
Yep.
If you're a hog driver, by the way, and have never been to Pima, the exhibit there is incredible. It has
it's great.
Bing 1 and Bing 2, I think now there's two of them or something. There's a really touching exhibit to Muck Brown. It's incredible.
Oh yeah, no, it's good. But yeah, not. Yes, that place, the Bing is the Bing was alive and well, and a lot of good memories from Bagram at that point. It'd just be the place that you go to hang out after sortie, or on the roof, the roof mostly.
The roof of the Bing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mostly.
Because at night, because you could see the stars.
Oh yeah, you'd go up. That is Matt's quote at the start of your book about nights in Afghanistan. Mm. Man. Yeah. You can just go up there, drink non-alcoholic beer, smoke some cigars. And Rain's probably Rain did it and all those things, and some of the stuff, turn the lights off in Afghanistan and that is a sight to behold.
Wow.
Yeah, not a lot of cultural lighting.
No.
Hey, you mentioned Scorpion. You've flown the Scorpion, Jahimix, and now whatever the F-35 magic helmet that I imagine combs your hair and does all this stuff while you're wearing that thing.
It's beautiful. Don't.
Yeah, I mean it's amazing.
Don't get stolen.
For another day, another story. But yes, they're expensive helmets. Can you talk the difference between each one of those?
Yeah. So the Scorpion. Let's start with Jahimix. So the Jahimix joint helmet mounted queuing system. So it's just attaches on the top, helmet mounted queuing sight, monochrome, green, can't wear night vision goggles with it. Very, very air to air centric. So an amazing helmet mounted queuing system for air to air. Scorpion, very, very good at air to ground queuing. And then especially how it got integrated into the A-10 with the PVI, pilot vehicle interface, was amazing. But Scorpion instead of being displayed, or Jahimix where it's displayed on your visor, the Scorpion was, it was displayed on a monocle. So a la the Apache helmet, but it was on a monocle that was just right here. Then the visor would go, the sun visor or clear visor would go over the top of it, and it was full color. So different things on the ground, like if I put a target on the ground or like a TOI, if you will, it would be red. And then a friendly position would be green, and you could draw lines on your map, and then that would display. And then additionally is you could cue all of your sensors with just a single long actuation on the stick. So what I would do is, like, I could look outside on the ground, and one, the targeting pod, it had a dash green square of what the targeting pod, like what was on the screen in the targeting pod, that's physically overlaid on the ground. And then you could do that. And then I could just look at something and my targeting pod would go where my eyes were going on the ground. And that was great. The biggest thing of it was that you could wear the Scorpion with night vision goggles, because the night vision goggles went on top of the monocle. So you had color cueing. So you had all your daytime cueing, all your all weather, all night, like all kinds of things cueing while being able to have NVGs. And then additionally, if you didn't want that data, you could move the monocle or you could turn it off. And so like that was big. So it was a lot more pilot friendly, in my opinion.
That was on the Scorpion or the one that you're using now?
That was on the Scorpion. Wow. So you could just turn it off. It's like, hey, I don't need it. I don't need any of my targeting data in my eyeball. I can just go ahead and turn it off. So those are the big things. So Scorpion, the fact that I could just flip my MBGs down on top of that was game changing. It was pretty great.
Were you one of the first guys then to be using NVGs, or they would have been in use for a while?
No.
I think I'm losing my timeline now.
No,
that would have been NVGs.
NVGs were like mastered by hog pilots of yore. By the time I got by the time I got in, don't let the gray hair fool you. I'm not that old, but frat Hayden out here. But no, those like the NVG like. Night tactics had been fully vetted. People were like, those were tried and true. But then just putting MVGs on top of the Scorpion, that was good. And I had a lot of great instructors. Like there's the first three instructor pilots in the A-10 qualified on the Scorpion. We're in the 74th and teaching all of us how to do it. So it was great.
Who were they?
Oh gosh. Lorenzo Harris, McGraw Mitchell, and I believe our DO Scud Curley was one of the first guys that just like got so our weapons officer, the DO, and then just one of the flight commanders, McGraw Mitchell, is probably the best instructor I've ever flown with. But they were like the first three guys.
Oh, cool.
And then McGraw took a couple of them in a travel pod out to Whiteman and taught all the Whiteman dudes how to use it, got those guys spun up, and then it just kind of festered through the community as the actual helmet proliferated.
Oh, cool.
It's great. But that's epic. That was another thing. I apologize. Jump in. It's like they handed us this helmet. They said, it's great. Figure out how to use it. You guys can go ahead and just qualify everyone on it. And they did it. And it was
wow.
And it was great. It was like every other platform had had this big, long syllabus on how to use their helmet-mounted queuing system. And the A-10 community was just like, we'll just figure it out. It'll be great. And,
that's awesome. Oh, well, switching the Jahimix from like one of those night turn day sorties, wearing NVGs and then like, all right, hey, I want to get my Jahimix. I mean, I have to take my helmet off and then make sure I don't jack it up by messing. Cause there's like what, 32 or so different little pins, and if you bend a pin, boom, you just wasted $100,000 and you're going to hear about it. Like the Jahimix was a pain to switch between those two, and then also not having that data, which would be really nice to have it over your eyeball. Working with NVGs would have been really, really nice.
Yep.
One or the other, I think.
And so you would have been trying to switch between those things while you're flying at what, 600 miles an hour in an F-16, 30,000 feet in the sky or something?
Yeah. That makes it sound more dramatic than it actually is, but
but you'd be jostling around, right? Yeah. I mean, yeah, I'm getting nervous just thinking about it.
Yeah, it's pretty intense. Only a very select few of individuals can actually handle it. So, no, Yeah, you can put on altitude hold and then, you know, take your helmet off. You got the access ear, you know, so you still can hear the radio. But I mean, I guys could change it out. I was not good enough nor willing to risk it. Like, I would take my helmet off and then I would take my Jihimix out of the little bag that I've been flying with all night and then put it on my helmet and then put my helmet back on. Uh-huh. And that was my safe way of not breaking that thing. Because, again, the pins on it, it was like back in the you know, old school serial monitor, like those serial type cables where it has 16, 24, 32 pins. And, you know, if you just misaligned it just ever so slightly, you're going to bend it and break it. And I think once you bend it and break it, you've broken it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Someone's going to be really pissed at you. You're not going to have a Jihimix. So don't do that.
Don't do that.
I want, cause I think you guys can talk to this, the opening of the book, the story of Afghanistan and FATS, like this video. I mean, I remember watching in IFF and pilot training, the close air support, these A-10s laying down danger close for guys who are taking heavy contact. Like, I mean, I get goosebumps thinking about it. Like, I think every fighter pilot's probably watched that, but I know like Flash can talk to it and how, I mean, I'm curious how you're able to get to that story, the interview, what your thoughts are on about. And then I know Flash, you probably can jump in there with some personal anecdotal evidence.
Okay, got the red smoke.
Roger. Gun runs north to south, west of the smoke, west of the smoke.
Okay, copy, west of the smoke. I'm looking at danger close now.
Roger, keep your fires west of the smoke. Commander's initials, Bravo Golf. Keep the fucking fire west of the smoke. We have three smokes pop.
Okay, copy that. I am visual to smoke. I'm going to keep my fires west of the smoke. And west of the road.
Roger, I see you. Come on, Winnipeg, give it to me. I need it. You're clear hot.
Can't be cleared hot.
Got visual to smoke. You as usual, and copy to the west. Long range straight.
Altitude.
You got me, right?
Gotcha.
Okay, make sure you got me. Go ahead, give it to me, over. Two, same spot. Look for me. Keep him west. Two, still taking fire from the west.
All right, dude. Make it low angle strafe. I want it closer.
Two. Okay, one. I need it on the west hillside. The west bank. Just west. I need it on the west bank.
I understand the west bank of the river.
West bank, it gives me hell. Still give it to me in the grove.
Okay, one's in from the north. I've got the west bank of the river. Two's gonna give it to you in the grove.
Roger, give me that gun run. Right along that bank, baby.
In hot.
Clear hot.
Altitude.
Give me some more smoke.
We're moving.
Which way?
We're moving east. Give me the fire south in the grove.
Okay, understand south.
One, you're clear hot in the grove.
South or west?
South.
Altitude. Pull up.
Two. Westbound 2, westbound gun run 2. 2, you're clear hot 2.
Okay, understand West Bank where I just strafed a couple passes ago?
That's A-firm, so you're clear hot.
He's in from the north, clear hot. Once you go over to truck cars, you start launching the grips.
Just east of those rounds! Just east of those rounds! West-south!
Acknowledge. Understand, east of number two's rounds.
That's A-firm. Just east of walk south. Clear hot.
Copy. Cleared hot. One's in from the north. Confirm you're still moving east.
Altitude.
Back up, no contact, where do you want
me
next?
Okay, 2, ridge line to my southeast, give me gun runs, over.
2 copies of ridge line to the southeast.
Not much place on smoke.
Watch, the friendly vehicle is moving north on the road. 2 is in on the ridge line to the southeast.
Roger, 2, right over my head, clear hot.
All right, Massive, give me a smoke and give me a Willy Peep mark on where you want the next ones.
Okay, I'll try. I'll give you smoke. I don't know about Willy Peep.
I got 100 rounds. We got 278. All right, we're running short on 30 millimeter.
Yeah, so it's interesting. That first chapter ended up being one of the last things that I... It might have been the last thing that I wrote, actually, because I got to near the end of the book and I realized... Oh, I actually need to like convey to like maybe readers who aren't super interested in airplanes and stuff, like to get them to care about what the A-10 does. And the way to do that is to try and show like, okay, here's an example of it helping folks out. And I reached out to a couple of hog drivers and I was like, hey, do you know if there's anyone I could talk to who has, you know, been saved by an A-10 and can speak to this? And they were like, oh, well, we can put you in touch with Matt Secor, who was part of the unit that was, saved by this really famous video with Fats and Raz that was now... Is it still used for training? I know it was for a really long time.
The video?
I don't know if it's still used. Yeah.
Unknown, but I do know that in 2011, it most certainly was.
Okay. So, and so I think I first got in touch with Matt Secor, and then after we had talked a fair bit, he was like, oh, I should put you in touch with Fats, and then Fats can get you in touch with Raz. And through that, I realized, oh, I could tell this story of we're in Secor's perspective on the ground, and then we can kind of like transport up into the sky and what were the hog drivers seeing versus what was Secor seeing. And the way that hog drivers are so intimately connected with JTACs also allowed me, I think, to tell something that was very like... what's the word, like melded together really closely, because everybody was sort of on the same wave. Like they're experiencing slightly different things, but the hog drivers could really empathize with what Matt Secor was going through. And it ended up just being, it was interesting because I remember I wrote a first draft of it. My buddy is going to smile when he hears this. I wrote a first draft and it was kind of quick. And he was like, my buddy Dave Dahl, who I'll shout out, he was watching, I showed him the clip of the video of Fats and Raz, and he was like, when you hear Matt's voice in there, he's, you know, it's really intense. He's still keeping his cool, but it's like, you can feel the danger of that moment. And my buddy was like, he's like, dude, you need to like amp this up a little bit so that readers can really feel that. And I think that's when then I like had some follow-up calls with Fats and Raz, who were able to give me a lot more detail and I think really appreciate the magnitude of what was happening. So it's one of those things that in retrospect, it's like, oh, of course I should have begun there. But, you know, it just sort of not until the very end. I tell that with students sometimes, too. It's like, oh, it's like your last paragraph needs to be your first paragraph, that kind of thing. So
yeah, I thought it was great. I mean, I've seen the video. I've been in situations not as intense as the one that Fats and Raz have in my career, which actually is a good thing. But like, I was hooked from, so
oh, that's awesome.
So as an A-10, as a former A-10 pilot, like, I was hooked from the beginning, and I thought it was a great way to start the book. The fact that you wrote it last, it's crazy to me. I don't know how you do that. You're a more talented writer, obviously, by having a published book, and things of that nature. But yeah. But no, that I was telling Rain, so just a little bit, expanding on that story is, yes. So you show up to A10B course, the basic course, and, by the way, shout outs are free. You can just shout out whoever you want. People love it. In fact, it's how you get people to listen to podcasts sometimes.
That's right. Got a name drop.
Name drop shout outs. But yeah, so my weapons officer, McGruff Hunt, like was, he showed the video, and in the A10, you finish the course combat mission ready, or like mission qualified. So you finish the course mission qualified. So he showed the video. This is before we've learned anything about systems, before we learned anything. It's like, you're welcome to the squadron moment. And it's about a 5 to 6 minute video. And everyone's just sitting there, and it's like, and McGruff just goes, if you are not prepared to do that on your first sortie after these 6 to 7 months of training, you can go ahead and leave.
Wow.
And everyone, like, no one in my class left. I have been told that one person did once. But it was just one of those things where it's kind of just like your book, like it just gets you into the mindset of what it takes to be a hog driver. And I think you probably can speak, can expand on this as well. And please do. Is in your conversations with A-10 pilots, you actually can sense like an emotional attachment to the mission and an emotional attachment. And everything that was ever taught to me when I was flying A-10s was through the lens of the 18-year-old on the ground. Mm-hmm. And it's like, no matter what is happening, understand who you are supporting, and that you are, everything you do is about the 18-year-old carrying a rifle. And so that was kind of the, just ingrained in every attack pilot and every hog driver that, that I had. And, if you can speak to that, that would be great. But like, the whole thing is, you have to be at your best. It was in the footnote, don't F this up. It's like, you gotta be good.
Yes.
Like, you have to be, at your best on everyone on the ground's worst day. Like, that was what was taught. And every hog driver has that mentality, both in CSAR and CAS and things of that nature. Did you experience that? Did you get that kind of like when you were talking to some of those guys? And talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I definitely did. It took me a while to like appreciate it, because I remember when I was first speaking with Pierre, and I had talked to some hog drivers and stuff over the phone, but I think it was when we started really meeting in person that sunk in for me, because Pierre kept telling me, he's like, whatever you do with this book, you got to emphasize that the people and the culture around this thing, that's what matters. It's not this particular airframe. It's the culture of close air support and what that actually involves. And it's this totally selfless devotion to protecting the ground. And I used to hear terms and words like, oh, you know, such and such is so humble. They have tremendous humility. But when I spoke with hog drivers, I was like, oh, that's what this looks like and feels like. And it doesn't mean it's only exclusive to them, but I was just so struck by it with hog drivers. Like, I got none of that, there was no arrogance or anything. It was just, it was so, almost like a universal warmth I felt from folks, which also maybe just happened to be because they were like kind in general. But I would imagine there's an overlap there between, if you are going to devote your life to, you have the skill set and all of the unique sort of physical properties to be able to fly any kind of, or almost it seems like any kind of airframe in the world. And if you chose to fly the A-10 among everything else, that also just speaks to this tremendous humility, like to choose to be like, I'm not going to fly twice the speed of sound ever, maybe in my life. I guess Flash, you're an exception since you've jumped around, but like, you know, like I don't, there's something so unique about that. And to devote oneself to the ground, I kept hearing that. And it wasn't until I started speaking to folks and the, the seriousness with which they talked about their mission is what really struck me as well. And I know I've already mentioned it, but I love that, you know, the story I got from someone about what's your sort of most memorable story, they didn't even fire the gun. You know, it's just about protecting the folks on the ground, whatever that looks like, whatever it whatever form it takes.
Absolutely. Yeah. That is something that
I think that,
oh, go ahead.
I was like, that perfectly describes the Sea Model Squadron. I think that's the same exact experience you'd have.
It's exact. It's the exact same everywhere. It's the exact same.
Humility.
It's interesting because then you have like this, once the A-10 was like going away and they like randomly knee-jerk shut down a couple squadrons and those guys went out and kind of permeated into other communities, it actually, I think that was a good thing, is you do get like very stovepiped in your airframe, and the mentality and the culture and like the cross culture, I will say the cross culture of the F-35 is something that's very interesting. But like in the SEED mission is you are destroying in a mission from a machine. Like you are like, it's the emotional attachment to that mission is not necessarily there. And it's like, something is emitting. I need to make the emission go away so that it doesn't have that emission anymore, so it can't shoot something. And what kind of was, it was just a bar conversation, was taking the A-10 like CAS mindset into every other mission that can be done by any other airframe is something that will serve people well, where it's like, okay, I'm doing SEED so that less survivable platforms or more platforms that are going to do the mission to help the 18-year-old with the rifle on the ground can physically be here. And so the C-130s can resupply the army. And so the C-17s can land here, and so we can forward deploy. We need to take these things out. So now, like, when you have all these different mission sets that are of the more exquisite variety, that you need all these very, very high tech platforms that to perform, is as long as you still tie it back to that 18-year-old with a rifle, is you can still get that same sort of kind of visceral response to a mission, and you can kind of get a little bit more engaged with it and do it better, in my opinion. So that kind of, that culture serves a lot of people well, which I'm glad, very glad that I got to start out in it. And I still try to remain very, very close to it with some of that stuff. But like I said, as we're getting on the podcast, like, I just, again, want to tell people is like, go out and get Hal's book. Because it's a good read to kind of get you into that mindset, and then also kind of can you can take it into your everyday life, like as far as just like how you interact and what truly matters when you're trying to come up with these complex solutions.
Mm-hmm. I feel like what you're describing, this is so interesting. There's probably another like story idea here for someone down the road, but the idea of like how a culture is cultivated. And the way to connect that back to like finding one's purpose or reminding folks of here's what the purpose is of what you're doing. And it's really interesting to hear the ways that you can, what you're saying is that it's not that it's impossible for that to happen in different platforms and stuff. It's just that there needs to be a conscious effort to continue to help have that happen. With the A-10, it seems like in part it's like this thing flies so slowly and can fly so low that like, well, you're using binoculars so you can see the folks on the ground, you know, and it may be, not that it makes that easier, but it enhances that intimacy, so to speak, and that there can be some more work.
And it was always the guys that, so I have a quick story for you. So two guys in my squadron, so I was nowhere near this sortie, but they went out two ship in Afghanistan and got called to, they ended up both get, or at least one of them got a DFC from this sortie, but they ended up going and supporting this group of dudes on the ground, and they took some casualties and things of that nature. But the thing was, is like, they like Screech and Pong land, and they get into a vehicle and drive and meet up with those guys that they just supported on the ground that were like, that went to the FOB. Like, they made it wow. back to the FOB, and it's like, okay, we're going to get in the car and drive down and see how they're doing. And then almost to a unit, every unit that we supported, like a JTAC attached to an Army unit or a JTAC attached to a Marine unit or anything of that nature, that JTAC would then take that. They would all rotate through Bagram to go home, and they would all stop by our squadron on the way out. And wow. so it was like that, again, that interaction was, it just put a face to the voice on the radio, and it really drove home the purpose of what you were doing. So that was like, that was something that struck me as an A-10 pilot, was just like, no kidding. The dudes we're supporting, those are human beings that we can actually talk to, that actually have lives and are going to go home. And we are going to, they're not just kind of abstract things that we are going out to do, or this future fight that we're constantly preparing for. It is a true human being that we spoke to and either went home or did not based on our performance. And yeah, so that was kind of the thing that was instilled in us the entire time, kind of growing up in that. And that's something that's kind of gone with me, and that's every A-10 or every hog driver kind of going through. I'm just glad to have gotten to be a part of it for a small amount of my career, which is great. But
that's incredible. I mean, the word that just keeps coming back to me is it's an odd one, but it's such an intimate platform, or such a, you know, an intimate community, like that closeness with each other and who you're supporting. It just seems kind of unmatched. So
small and getting smaller.
Yeah, valid. I thought you put it in a perspective I've never thought about, which was like seed. It's, you're going out there to destroy a thing, a mechanism that is emitting radiation so that it hopefully won't be able to shoot at something else later on down the road. But when you have, Harold throw in the video of Fats. Like, when you watch that video or when you hear the JTAC's voice, when you hear like just the conversations going back, I mean, like, you're tied, like, individuals could die if you don't do your job. And then being able to put together, like, it's a very personal thing. So I never really thought of it in that aspect, but obviously the A-10, that is what you're doing. You're out there helping. You're a firefighter, man, with a big old gun.
Yeah.
Saving lives.
Oh yeah. And I remember Screech coming back and telling that story. He's like, I told him, he's like, we're going to be here a minute, short trigger squeezes and low angle strafe. So 75 feet recovery. And we got to get close because of how close the friendlies are, to the enemy, and all these different things that seems crazy, but it's what those guys do every day. And it's what they train to. And it's just something that is just so instilled in them that, it needs to become routine. Just like, you talked about in the book, it's just like, you gotta be good. And those guys are, and I appreciate you highlighting the culture and, the story. Cause a lot of the stories I had not heard before. I did not know who Pierre Spray was. And I'm glad I do now. So thank you very much for telling that story.
Oh, well, thank you for all the kind words and for just taking the time to read the book too. I mean, writing a book is kind of a lonely thing. So get to talk about it with folks and to talk to fighter pilots and attack pilots. And that's just sort of a dream for me. I'm living out a childhood dream, which is cool.
Awesome. Well, before we blast, is there any parting shots before we wrap up? Flash, you have anything, Hal?
I don't think so, actually.
No's an okay answer.
Yeah, I think no.
Where can people find the book?
Yeah.
Where can they find you? What's next? It sounds like the psychology that goes in, that's going to be one to peel back the onion and figure out the psychology that goes into cultures of the fighter community. But yeah.
So the book can anywhere like independent bookstores, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, all those different places should have it. I don't actually have social media stuff, but if you go to my website, it's just halsunt.com. there's like a thing where you can contact me or whatever. And if you want to shoot me an email through that, I'd be happy to respond. It's fun to talk about airplanes with folks. And my next idea, it's going to sound boring at first, but I think I want to write a book about insurance, because it's this thing that like is everywhere in our life. But
yeah,
whenever I ask anyone to explain it to me, they can't really. Like, I sort of get how it works, but I know I have to pay a premium and whatever. Like, but I'm like, how is that calculated? How do we do this? And I think it would be really interesting to read a book about, like, how did this thing come to be? Why is it the way it is? So I'm working on it, but it's such a like a big subject, and I really don't want it to be boring. So I'm trying to do the work to like find some interesting stories within it. But I like to write about stuff that like helps me understand the world better, and I think that would be a cool angle.
Hey, the Big Short figured out a way to make mortgages interesting, like the story of mortgages.
Exactly.
Hey, if there's somebody that can make it interesting, like I have no doubt that you can, because you're a hell of a writer. It was a great read. Please keep it up. I know it's your first book, not gonna be the last. And you got a fan in this guy, and I think Rain is as well. So,
yeah, agreed.
Oh, thank you again so much for having me.
Awesome. Well, thanks for joining us. I'll have it linked down below. And again, Flash, man, it was great having you on here as well. I think, again, people are going to be hearing a little bit more of Flash's voice in the near future, so get up for that. But, yeah, all right, guys. Enjoyed it. Cheers.
Cheers.
Thank you. Cheers.
The Afterburn Podcast is a proud supporter of Guns, Gear, and Memorial Foundation, helping our veterans and their families when they need it most. To learn more, visit GunsGarin.com/rain.
I want to tell you about a service I've been using for over a year now, Aurora. I signed up, and they immediately identified over 60 data brokers out there selling my information. The best part is they go right to work removing your information from these data brokerages. I have a link down below where you get a 14-day free trial. It's risk-free, and you can cancel anytime. So it's worth taking a shot and seeing what information is out there. But it's more than just that. They have an app which includes antivirus, VPN, password management, all built into one package. You can use the app or you can use the browser to stay safe out there in the digital space. Again, I have a link down below. You can check it out for 2 weeks free. And if you don't like it, you can cancel anytime.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.